Today is January 8th, 2019, and welcome to another National Creditors Bar Association Creditors Rights In-Depth Podcast. Today's topic is the Obeski versus McCarthy and Halthus oral arguments at the United States Supreme Court. And joining us for our podcast is Britt Sattel, who works in the Pennsylvania office of Barron & Neuberger, PC. She's a member of the firm's Consumer Financial Services Law Practice Group, and prior to joining that, Britt was a shareholder at Burton Neal & Associates, where she served as the firm's Director of Compliance. In addition to her litigation experience, Britt is experienced in the creation, implementation, and administration of policies, procedures, and compliance management systems. Her non-litigation experience also includes the handling of regulatory complaints. She has substantial familiarity with multiple consumer protection financial laws and has trained collectors and facilitated law firm audits by clients in the financial sector. She is also president of the Pennsylvania State Creditors Bar Association and has been a speaker at programs sponsored by the NCBA as well as the Pennsylvania Creditors Bar Association, and she has also been a guest blogger for the National List of Attorneys. Britt, welcome.
Thanks, Mark. Good morning.
So I assume it was hopefully an exciting day at the Supreme Court yesterday for you, and so let's jump right into it, and in this case, of which the NCBA has had an amicus filed on its behalf, what did you see the justices struggling most with yesterday?
So a couple things. I think the justices really struggled with how is non-judicial foreclosure different from just a typical car repossession matter, and that really came through in the petitioner, Daniel Geiser, who was arguing for the petitioner Obeski, in his arguments. He relied on that hypothetical of the car repossession man very heavily in his brief, and it came out in his argument. It's something the court struggled with, and very early on, Justice Gorsuch and Justice Alito pressed, you know, Mr. Geiser on that argument, and at one point, Geiser conceded that the principal purpose is to enforce the security interest. So, you know, when the repo man is done, he delivers the car to the creditor. And Justice Gorsuch, you know, jumped all over him and said, well, then why don't you lose the case? Doesn't that just concede your case away? And I thought that was a real turning point. Interestingly enough, though, I think that it's still a question that a lot of the justices were struggling with. I think it was a question of, you know, what makes non-judicial foreclosures different than just collecting debt. It was something that clearly Justice Kavanaugh struggled with in his questioning, both of Mr. Geiser and Mr. Shanmugam, who was arguing for the respondent, as well as Justice Breyer had a few questions as well. So, yeah, Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh were really struggling to reconcile how non-judicial foreclosures is different.
So obviously not an easy case for them thus far, in your opinion.
I don't think it's going to be an easy case for them. I think our industry got very lucky in Henson v. Santander and Sheriff v. Gilley with the unanimous decisions. I think this case is probably going to be more along the lines of, you know, the 5-3 decision we got in Midland versus Johnson.
Okay. So I know one of the other topics within there is around states' rights and interest in governing property rights and whether the FDCPA would be an unwelcome infringement upon that. From your fellow colleagues in the NCBA, states' rights issues and where the providence of law of governing a lot of these kind of situations in our industry fall is vastly of interest to everyone. So did they discuss or touch on the states' rights issue yesterday?
They touched on them in Mr. Shanmugam's argument very, very briefly. Really, Justice Sotomayor, who is not necessarily a friend to the industry, as most people know, she was a bit adversarial and wanted to know, you know, how would this conflict with state laws and would it really make a difference? And, you know, Mr. Shanmugam did his best, but, you know, Justice Sotomayor flatly said for her, it's about the unfairness of the issue. She also thought it was odd that Congress would include judicial foreclosures as subject to the FDCPA, but not non-judicial foreclosures. So she seemed to think that that was a problem. There was a bit of the states' rights argument propounded by the attorney from the United States Justice Department. Frankly, I don't think it added a lot either way. That's my personal opinion. I should probably say all of this is based on my personal opinion. I'm not speaking on behalf of my law firm or the NCBA. These are all just based on my personal experiences yesterday. But unfortunately, I didn't see the states' rights issue come up as much as I thought it should have, as much as I thought it was really important. I know that's something that the NCBA amicus brief touched on. It's something that the Commercial Law League brief touched on. Something the Colorado Mortgage Lenders Association brief touched on. And I think it was a missed opportunity, for better or for worse. I think that Mr. Geiser started off with his repo man argument, and that's kind of where everything was headed after that.
In terms of, you know, when you look at the overall case, and I know that you've had an opportunity to look at our amicus and hear the various arguments, what do you think are some of the important aspects that come down for our members, depending upon which way this you know, turns in terms of the decision that comes out? Say if they reverse the position or reverse the decision, what impact does that have?
So if they reverse the decision, what's interesting about this case is that it was not decided on a motion for summary judgment at district court. So at the district court, the District Court of Colorado dismissed on a motion to dismiss. So if this case were reversed, it would basically have to go back and be completely litigated, which I think is interesting. I think that that means that even though this decision does have ramifications about how any members who do non-judicial foreclosures might want to rethink whether or not they really need to strongly comply with the FDCPA, I don't think it's necessarily the end of the matter, so to speak, as far as this case goes. I think that as a compliance attorney, I am, and I tell, you know, all my clients this, I am very conservative when it comes to compliance. Like, if you think you might possibly, maybe kind of, sort of, might fall under the FDCPA, just comply with it. It's a lot easier than having to litigate it and spend, you know, the hundreds of thousands of dollars, in some cases, like, you know, taking a matter up to the Supreme Court with costs. So I do think that, you know, if it is a non-judicial foreclosure, I think, you know, right now I don't think it's worth rushing out and making any snap decisions. Certainly we want to wait and see what the court does. But I also think that the justices were really struggling as to why non-judicial foreclosure is not the same as debt collection. And even though there were very good arguments about the animating purpose being a clear demand for payment, which was another area the court struggled with, I think a lot of the justices kind of think that, you know, yeah, maybe it is debt collection. So hopefully it won't have a huge impact, but members certainly need to, you know that they need to be complying with the FDCPA, and for those who practice in non-judicial foreclosure, you know, maybe be prepared, have a plan in place in case this does go against the industry.
In terms of the amicus briefs that were filed, was there any mention of any, either ours or any of the other ones that had been filed in this case?
Not specifically. There was a brief mention by Mr. Geiser, who was asked to point to a section in his brief relating to a particular point. I believe the question was posed by Justice Breyer, and he said, well, it's in our brief, and it's in some of the, you know, amicus briefs, and that was it, kind of before moving on to another line of questioning. So it, you know, didn't come up in oral argument. That certainly doesn't mean that the justices may not consider them, you know, once they're back in their chambers and reviewing the whole case.
Sure, which leads me to my next question. For those of us who only have a brief modicum of legal knowledge, what will be the next step in this particular case?
Okay, so the next step is, now that the case has officially been submitted, is the lingo that the Supreme Court uses, the justices are going to go back, and typically they have a conference on Fridays, and they all sit around a big conference table and talk about the cases and talk about the arguments they heard. Typically what will happen is there will be, you know, maybe some sort of, I don't know if it's a formal vote, to be honest, but in the books and things I've read, you know, they'll kind of take a sense of the gathering, so to speak, and come, you know, really see, okay, where are we falling on this case? Figure out what the majority opinion is going to be, whether or not, you know, it's a unanimous opinion, and then the Chief Justice, as his prerogative, will assign the majority brief out, which will then get circulated among the justices. Same thing will happen for the dissent. And eventually we'll get an opinion. It is known that Justice Roberts likes to have as much agreement as possible among the justices, which I think is why, at least for in the industry and in the three cases that have come up in the last couple of years to the Supreme Court, two of the three are unanimous decisions. So we know Roberts likes to get, you know, as much unanimity as possible. I don't know that that's possible in this case. So that's the next step. It's kind of a wait and see, because all of this is done behind closed doors. So I think we can expect an opinion, you know, way later in the term, hopefully May, in time for our conference, and if not, definitely by the end of the term in June.
Excellent. As we're rounding up towards the end of our time here, any final thoughts or comments to share with our listeners today in terms of the case, or what they ought to be watching for and keeping their eyes open towards as we move forward on this one?
You know, I think the thing that I'm going to be interested in seeing is which justices become the swing vote in this. I think it's pretty clear we know where Justice Sotomayor falls, probably also where Justice Kagan falls. I think based on the questioning, Justice Alito was a little more hostile to the petitioner's position. So I think the swing votes could end up being Chief Justice Roberts, possibly Judge Kavanaugh, both of which are interesting because they're both very, you know, were seen as pro-business appointees. I know one article I read this morning said that Gorsuch could be a swing vote. Personally, based on what I saw, I'm not sure I would put him down as a swing vote. I think he got a very large concession out of petitioner's attorney. So we'll see. I think that the place of the swing vote, that the role of the swing vote now that Justice Kennedy is off the court, is certainly moving towards Justice Roberts. But I think the consumer's bar might be surprised, and they might have found some support from Justice Kavanaugh in this case.
Interesting.
But don't hold my feet to the fire on that one. I could end up being completely wrong. That's kind of the trick with the Supreme Court, is you really never know what they're going to do.
Well, I'll give you the last call and projection on it. How do you think it's going to come out?
I don't know. I don't think I can say one way or another. I do think it's going to be much more of a split decision along the lines of Midland v. Johnson.
Okay.
I think that there are a couple of justices on both sides, and then it's going to come down to three or four justices in the middle.
Excellent. Well, you've put us on the edge of our seat for the next podcast to have you back when the decision gets made.
Please, I look forward to it.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Britt, for insightful and timely news just coming off of the Supreme Court oral arguments yesterday. And we look forward to having you back when this comes to its final conclusion.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mark.
Great. Thanks, Britt.